traduction française et une traduction anglaise en seront données simultanément par dispositif téléphonique.
Monsieur le Président.
I am Norman Corwin, and the name of this program is The First Big Try. It's about an experiment that didn't work, and by that fact cost millions of lives and measureless agonies. The Big Try was the League of Nations. Nobody under 40 will remember it in the daily headlines, but both the fall of the League and what it bequeathed has affected and will continue to affect every last one of us. We begin in a minute from now.
I award the blue ribbon to...
Yes.
Paul?
A checkup. Finally, in one cavity.
Great. How'd you do it?
I brush with Crest now.
Ah, toothpaste is toothpaste. Oh, no, sir. Crest has fluoride. The others we tried didn't. Fluoride's the best cavity fighter you can get.
Crest can't promise only one cavity, but we can promise most people good checkups.
That is good news, son.
Fighting cavities is the whole idea behind Crest.
My name is Jaime Sotomayor, Treasurer of the Mission Area Federal Credit Union, with this message for you. The Mission Economic Opportunity Council wishes to announce the establishment of the Mission Area Federal Credit Union. We urge all the people in the Mission District to join us in creating the first financial institution owned by the Mission residents. For further information, call 282-8545 or come by our office at 828 Valencia Street here in San Francisco.
Oscillate in 24 minutes, the 26 years of the League's existence. Lord Avon, more familiar to us as Anthony Eden, former Prime Minister of Great Britain and one of the architects of modern diplomatic history.
First, to avert war by the just and peaceful settlement of all disputes. Secondly, if we fail in our first objective, to stop war. And it is by the League's effectiveness in realizing this aim that the League will be judged.
When I think that... Second is Philip Noel Baker, former British Minister of State and Nobel Peace Prize laureate.
...and Austin Chamberlain and Lord Balfour and other people of that caliber went to sit in the Council of the League, gave it a world prestige.
It began in Geneva, under the Alps, by the waters of the very blue lake. John Calvin slept here. So did Voltaire and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But never mind that. More to the point, in a world notoriously given to wars and threats of wars, Switzerland already had a reputation for neutrality. It was in Geneva that the International Red Cross made its home as long ago as the time of the American Civil War. But in 1919, the world had just come through what was, up to then, the most ghastly war in history. A black and white war, unsweetened by color on the tube in the living room. It had the glamour of a dead rat. It destroyed the youth of Europe, 25 millions of them, and it took 100,000 American lives on the way. It was the war, ho-ho, to make the world safe for democracy. Many people thought it a shocking disgrace that murder should be the chief preoccupation of nations, and a few idealists set about to do something about it. Lord Robert Cecil, the tall man here, wrote a memorandum that came into the hands of Woodrow Wilson and started him thinking toward a League of Nations, even planning toward it. Noel Baker recalls Lord Cecil and how he came to write that fateful memorandum.
When the wind was in the right direction, the barrages used to come over, and as he sat in his garden, he would think of what was happening in the trenches. And that, I think, moved him to write this memorandum, to urge that an international organization must be set up to ensure that there should never be another war.
Another war was the last thing on anybody's mind during the general celebration over armistice. And the leader whose country, through its intervention, had ensured an Allied victory, was the right man, the logical man, to escalate the armistice into something more lasting than a respite. The president traveled to Europe.
And Woodrow Wilson went round the continent, alas, not to the devastated areas of France, but he went to Rome, he went to Paris. In Rome, the president of the Senate, after he had addressed the two chambers of their parliament together, said, "Mr. President, you are not only the president of the United States, you are the president of us all." And Woodrow Wilson was the great prophet of the League. And without him, no League could have been made, because he forced it through the peace conference in Paris in 1919.
They came with the best intentions, these now quaint figures of men, mostly gone today. They came to Paris as delegates of Allied nations to write a peace treaty. And if sometimes they move across your screen like puppets with jerky brusqueness, lay it to the hand-cranked camera, not to any stiffness of their time or occupation. The details of the treaty they came to make were worked out at the Quai d'Orsay, in the heart of Paris. But when the time came to sign the papers, everybody went to Versailles, just 12 miles away. Now, for the first time, a meeting of great principalities was held in the open. The Germans had been given no seat at the Paris treaty table, but now they were about to face their victors. People still believed a world war was something somebody could win. Out of spit and polish limousines stepped premiers, generals, presidents. Within the Hall of Mirrors, guilt was assigned and punishment distributed. Germany had to concede sole responsibility for the war, pay huge reparations, surrender her colonies, give up Alsace-Lorraine. Austria was whittled down to the size of our 39th ranking state. The documents were done up in ribbons and seals. Signatures were taken as pledges of nations. And then the architects of the settlement, known as the Big Four, came out a bit self-consciously to pose for the hand-crank cameras and to appear before the transported people. Lloyd George of Britain, Orlando of Italy, Clemenceau of France, Woodrow Wilson of the United States. They were often at odds before and after this bright scene, but at the moment they were united. They believed in what they had done. They shared in the glory and the acclamation. Woodrow Wilson, with a sense of mission accomplished, went back to an America which had sustained not even a broken window under enemy action. He brought with him a League of Nations covenant openly arrived at. He was cheered, toasted, honored. The public was eager for ratification of the peace treaty and for joining the League. But there were political perils, chiefly in Congress. Senator Lodge of Massachusetts, super chief. There were fears that the League Covenant and our own Constitution would never get along. Humanity was seen calling God's judgment down on an isolationist Senate for killing the peace treaty.
Wilson began a campaign of speeches across the country, as marvelous as the speeches which he had made in Europe at the end of 1918 and in the first days of 1919. But unfortunately, in the middle of his campaign, he had a stroke. He went back to the White House, but he never really was in charge again. It was a most tragic thing. Wilson was defeated. The League became anathema in the eyes of the Congress of the United States.
We had entangled ourselves in a foreign war, but would not entangle ourselves in the peace treaty. We would not join. The first big try.
Last July, Armand Allness joined the San Francisco Opera Guild. It cost him $15. A month later, the guild invited him to a party where he met two opera stars and lots of other nice people. In September, the guild got Armand and a friend into a dress rehearsal of Madame Butterfly. They enjoyed themselves so much, Armand used his guild membership to get preferential seating for the real thing. By now, he was beginning to realize opera was a lot more exciting than he'd been led to believe. So he decided to do what any guild member can. He carried a spear in Il Trovatore. What happened to Armand can happen to you. Just join the Opera Guild. Dial Opera 72 for details. Today's Opera Guild wants to join you.
Sunday sun, let's go walking and we'll talk about some things. Kick my shoes off and we'll drink.
Helen Bentley is the most refreshing thing happening every morning on Channel 5. The Bentley affair makes you laugh, makes you think, keeps you informed about the most unusual things around the Bay Area. Join the Bentley affair every weekday morning at 9:30 on 5.
The West Coast Black Theater Alliance School of Dramatic Arts will present Laserbeam, a play in one act, Fridays and Saturdays, for the next two weekends at 8:30 p.m. in the Potrero Hill Neighborhood House, 953 DeHaro Street in San Francisco. The play will be presented in cooperation with the Neighborhood Arts Program. Admission will be a $1 donation for adults or a penny a pound for youngsters of all ages. Plan to attend.
Without membership of the United States, it seemed like only half a league onward. But onward it did go, nevertheless. Delegates arrived in Geneva in the fall of 1920. Lord Cecil, of course. Paderewski, the pianist president of Poland. Asians, Africans, Europeans, all but Americans. The League's agenda was stiff. Administer the Saarland, run the Free City of Danzig on the Baltic, establish an international labor organization in Geneva, set up a permanent court of international justice in The Hague. Even more urgent in human terms was the problem of hordes of war-displaced refugees. Still, there was optimism. Hopes ran high that at last the nations had come to maturity, that never again would the lunacy of settling differences by explosives be resorted to. At Locarno in 1925, a treaty was signed by Germany and other nations, accepting the frontiers laid down in Versailles, and the new republics of Czechoslovakia and Poland, which had sprung from the ribs of that treaty, relaxed and settled back for what they hoped would be an endless era of peace. 8 years after the armistice, a newly democratic Germany was admitted to membership. The Soviet Union was admitted by the League in the mid-1930s. The United States, though, still hung back, although she did join other nations in renouncing war. President Coolidge sent to Paris his Secretary of State, Kellogg, of the breakfast food family, to sign the Kellogg-Briand Act, another girder in the rising structure of peace. So life was not bad by the Lake of Geneva. In 1928, delegates felt the world was safe enough to take time out for boating, for golf. For garden parties with their ladies. Bernard Shaw came down from London for a look. And in 1929, less than a decade after Lord Cecil and the earliest delegates first came to town, the foundation stone of the Palace of the League of Nations was set. It was a cornerstone not only for a peace palace, but for the hopes of millions. The building rose to completion. The hopes faded all too soon. The palace of the League rose, but even as it did, Wall Street crashed, world trade plummeted, hunger and unemployment spread like a virulent plague. Political extremists came out of the woodwork. Under such pressures, the 50 nations of the League persisted in their search for peace. There were orators in those days. Aristide Briand had the stuff to stir an assembly.
Il leur suffira de dire solennellement et fortement, plus de guerre. Nous n'acceptons pas que dans aucun cas, pour aucune cause, dans aucune circonstance, la guerre que nous avons clouée au pilori comme un crime puisse se réveiller contre les peuples.
In its first 10 years, the Council of the League scotched local wars. At one time, it stopped four in a single week. Geneva was front and center in world affairs. To it came the reigning stars of international diplomacy. Beneš of Czechoslovakia. Briand, courteous of Germany. Scores of others. The League Secretariat was now 600 strong. The League had its own shortwave transmitters. Publications streamed from its presses. Documents on child welfare, the opium trade, armaments. The International Labor Organization, looking very reserved behind a high fence, rose alongside the League, an institution committed to improving conditions of labor throughout the world. To the north, in The Hague, a newly established world court functioned independently of the League, but with judges elected by the delegates in Geneva. The Forest Tribunal, nations could, did, and still do, bring legal disputes. By 1932, the League was ready to get down to one of the sternest realities of war and peace, the issue of disarmament. Arthur Henderson of Britain, who presided over the disarmament conference, sounded a warning of what might happen if the conference failed.
The world would again be in danger of rapidly expanding armaments. Are we ready to face our task?
I may venture to make concrete suggestions. The Japanese delegation are in favor of reduction in the size of battleships and in the caliber of their guns.
Dans les domaines navals.
Many proposals. Some accepted, some half accepted, some rejected. But all of it came to nothing when the German electorate voted into power the most fanatic of the world's extremists. A savage dispatch, he denounced the Versailles Treaty, took Germany out of the League, and started to arm for war. Nobody moved against him. The first death threat to the League came not from Germany, but from Japan, whose priests accommodatingly blessed and whose crowds cheered an army setting out to invade the Chinese province of Manchuria. Here were the first open strides on the road to World War II. First refugees in a column that was to straggle through many lands for 40 long years. The League met an emergency session to act on the conquest of Manchuria and assigned an investigating commission headed by Britain's Lord Lytton. The commission went to China and studied the ground. It was slow, tedious, painstaking business.
On the other side, on the left, the second building from the third building from the auditorium is the library.
13 months after he was commissioned, Lytton returned with a report which was adopted by the League Assembly and followed by an expected dissent from Japan.
Found that the Japanese occupation of this large part of China was not justified on the ground of self-defense, and that the new state which had been set up was a Japanese protectorate rather than a genuine case of Manchurian self-determination.
Japan's policy is fundamentally inspired by a genuine desire to guarantee peace in the Far East and to contribute to the maintenance of peace throughout the world. Japan, however, finds it impossible to accept the report adopted by the Assembly.
And now it came, the fateful walkout. The delegates from Tokyo simply snapped shut their briefcases and walked up the aisles and out of the league. A walk that led Japan all the way to Pearl Harbor and Hiroshima.
A super spy thriller, a top secret chiller. It's the Ipcress File on the KPIX Thursday Night Movie.
Someone is trying to frame me. You've got to help me.
But you're just too hot, Father.
Follow Harry Palmer. What happens to him concerns you. Yes, you. And you.
The Ipcress File was the making of a star for Michael Caine. He's brash, cocky, and shrewd. So shrewd that nothing escapes him, not even the dangerous secrets of the Ipcress File. Watch this top secret expose on the KPIX Thursday Night Movie this week at 9.
You will forget all about the Ipcress File. You.
Blood had been drawn from the body of the League, and the jackals moved in. Benito Mussolini, the man who gave fascism its name, suddenly decided that he had to avenge the defeat of an Italian army by Ethiopian tribesmen at Adowa in 1896, when Mussolini was 13 years old.
Mussolini, in my experience, alone, was a perfectly reasonable person to talk with. The histrionics were all kept for when there were more than one or two gathered together. At least that was my experience. We had an extremely difficult meeting. I completely failed to make any impression. Looking back on it now, I think he'd made up his mind long before ever I arrived in Rome. I remember one thing in particular that struck me. It's very interesting. He turned to me one time and he said, "Now, Adowa, look at Adowa. We have to avenge Adowa." And it struck me such an extraordinary point of view. But I said, what would have happened to us, the British, if we had to do that? We've had so many defeats, I don't know where we'd begin. Would we have to avenge Bunker's Hill? And if so, where would that lead us? And for a moment he smiled, but only for a moment. And there's no doubt it had eaten into him Italy had got to win back this lost reputation, as he thought it was, over Adowa.
The League swiftly condemned Italy as an aggressor, but was able to do little to help the victim except to call for economic sanctions and a trade embargo against Italy. Debate in the Assembly went on.
Le gouvernement éthiopien a le devoir de proclamer en toute loyauté que, subissant une guerre injuste, décidé à défendre jusqu'à la mort son indépendance et son intégrité. Quelque longue que doive être cette guerre, il ne cédera pas la force.
Messieurs les délégués, on ne supprime pas la guerre, on la remplace. Et on la remplace parce que l'histoire ne s'arrête pas. Si pour son compte, la société des nations s'arrête, l'histoire qu'on ne peut pas forcer par des sanctions poursuivra son chemin, car son chemin est la vie.
But what were words against the glory of war? Mussolini's aviator's son reported that a group of Ethiopian horsemen gave him the impression of a budding rose unfolding. as his bombs fell in their midst and blew them up. It was exceptionally good fun, he said. After 7 months of fighting, Addis Ababa fell, and its emperor fled with his dignity intact. To Geneva he went, to address the assembly that had helped him all too little. He apologized for being about to speak in his native Amharic, but he never got that far. Italian agitators in the press gallery saw to that.
ከተጀመረ በ1935 ዓ ም መጨረሻ የኢጣሊያን የአውሮፕላኖች በጦር ሰራዊት ላይ የጋዝ ላክሬሞጀን ያለበት ቦምብ ጣሉባቸው።
The applause was hollow. The League had ceased to function as a peacekeeping body. Within a month, there was civil war in Spain. After that, Hitler took over Austria and Czechoslovakia. Collective security was out. The dictators were in. Now a Second World War was only a matter of time. Still, the League did not give up. Rather than brood or despair, it found constructive work to do. It abolished slave trade in Liberia, set optimum housing standards for all regions of the world, tightened controls on narcotic drugs, and got governments to pool their information on drug traffic. Laid the foundation of a World Bank, organized a drive against malaria, a disease that infected a quarter of a billion people every year. The work of the League continued until the war it had hoped to avoid, the unthinkable World War II, cut off Geneva from the rest of the world. The first big try had failed. Failed in its biggest objective, though not in some of the lesser ones. Not exactly a total loss. For the need for a concert of nations was now greater than ever. The fallen torch of the League was picked up and carried across the world to be relit in San Francisco. Norway's Carl Hambro rose in the League Assembly in 1946.
I now declare the last meeting of the 21st and last Assembly of the League of Nations closed.
The League is dead. Long live the United Nations.
The United Nations has already lived longer than its predecessor. It is the second big try. If it ever fails, there may not be enough pieces left to try again.